is going to be TAS Senior Scholar Professor Jason Hill concluding his discussion about allegory, propaganda, and didacticism in the novels of Ayn Rand. I'd like to ask everyone to please share the room and please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Jason, thanks again for doing this topic. And yes, let's start with a recap of what we talked about last week.
Right. So last week, I really sort of focused definition on romanticism as really Rand characterizes it in the Romantic Manifesto as a 19th century movement, but it really is going by the proper definition from the various works, myriad works on romanticism, an 18th century literary movement that started. And so last week I talked about the basic fundamental characteristics of romanticism as it emerged in the 18th century among some of its major players like Wordsworth, Byron, Shelley, John Murray, various, I don't have all of my notes before me, but various romantics who were exemplars of the theme. And we went over various five characteristics of romanticism. That is an interest in the common man and childhood. Right? Was that interesting? It's one of the key features of romanticism, an interest in the common man and childhood. Strong senses, the prioritization of emotions and feelings over reason. An awe of nature and in the sublime, which is for the romantics rooted inside of nature. A celebration of the individual and the importance of imagination. So it was an 18th century movement in arts and literature that emphasized nature, imagination, quite often irrationality, very much so subjectivism and emotions. And the romantics, I said, emphasized the healing power of the imagination, believing that it could enable people to transcend their troubles and their circumstances, and that their creative talents could illuminate and transform the world into a coherent vision to regenerate mankind spiritually. I talked about one form of romanticism, which is called an exemplum, which is Latin for example. And I talked about the Fountainhead being an example of probably that kind of romanticism. That is, an exemplum is a story used to illustrate an ethical point. So basically, just to highlight again some other features of romanticism that I've talked about last week, that it is it's among other things a movement that also place the predominance of imagination and formal rules, classicism, over the sense of fact or the actual, that is, realism. It's a form of literature, art, we can say aesthetics, that surprisingly, or not so surprisingly, when you read the Romantics, valorizes the intuitive over the logical, right? Intuitive, imaginative perceptions that tend to speak a noble truth than that of fact, logic, or the here and now. So having done a lot of research and gone through all my papers that I wrote as an undergraduate majoring in literature, and also more importantly, the courses on the romantic novel that I've taught in my comparative literature classes at DePaul, my understanding was that Rand's works are not features of romanticism. There's something else, that Rand was creating a new theory of art and what she was calling Romanticism seemed to have had no sort of historical continuity between the concepts that she developed and the panoply of 18th century and 19th century conceptions of Romanticism that we find in the literature. So, sort of what I'd like to do today is to go through and look at what Rand actually has to say about Romanticism, and we'll see that there's a stark contrast between the attributes, the fundamental characteristics, which she attributes to Romanticism, and how starkly different they are from the 18th century. I think she's absolutely wrong. Romanticism did not begin in the 19th century. The literature that I talked about last week was all about 18th century Romanticism. But I want to defend, let me just say from the outset that Rand's theory of art I find to be enormously brilliant and insightful. I just don't think it's Romanticism, right? I just say that from the outset. So, excuse me, Rand says that art is a product of a man's subconscious integrations on page 93 of the Romantic Manifesto, of a sense of life to a larger extent than of his conscious philosophical convictions. Since artists, she says, like any other men, seldom translate their sense of life into conscious terms. All right. And then she further goes on to say that when people read Romanticism, what they find on page 94 is a plot structure. And the plot structure is implicit premise of volition and therefore of moral values. The same reason, the same reaction for the same subconscious reason is evoked by such elements as heroes or happy endings or the triumph of virtue or in the visual arts, beauty. Right? So I want to say that a plot structure is not unique to Romanticism, that we find it even in naturalistic art, and that volition as a premise in art is not necessarily something that leads to the suggestion of moral values in art. That volition as such is an indicator of how human beings choose to act, or it's a descriptor. It says nothing about the type of values that people will choose to elect, or the manner in which they will choose to elect those values. So I think if we look at the propagandistic art of Soviet realism or Russian realism or Nazi Germany, we can see that there are people who are acting of their own volition. This is disputable, but I think that there are cases where one could say that people are acting of their own volition in art, but did they choose moral values consonant with man's nature as a rational being? I would say no, that those ultimately collectivistic values that they chose were eventually destructive of man's nature and inimical to man's nature as a human being. So a plot structure in a story, I think, A, is neither the creation or the exclusive province of Romanticism. We find it in medieval plays. We find it in Shakespeare's plays, medieval dramas, I should say. We find it in Greek tragedies, although in her lecture on the aesthetic vacuum of our age, Rand has an extensive disagreement with plot being existent in the Greek tragedies, which would be a conversation for another time. I find myself disagreeing with her there. But a plot structure also, simpliciter, does not commit me to value-oriented sense of life at all. Any novel can have a serial killer as its protagonist, and the novel commits itself to a brilliant plot structure, but it is suffused with a malevolent sense of life, right? The protagonist and the, let's call him the denizens of his world, do not at all pursue a value-oriented sense of life. So to then say it's proof, it's not romanticism, would sort of, I think, beg the question. Now, if we go back to this idea that Rand holds as an attribute of Romanticism, that art is the product of man's subconscious interrogations or integrations of his sense of life to a larger extent than those of his conscious philosophical convictions. I mean, I would probably say that, and I'm going to call this Exhibit A, that in response to that, we may say that neither Atlas Shrugged nor The Fountainhead are those types of novels, right? That is where, that their subconscious displays of a sense of life rather than the conscious philosophical convictions of the protagonists. Because the speeches, the talks, are not subconsciously held values, but consciously worked out, explicitly worked out philosophic principles that, for example, in The Fountainhead, show and prove the incontrovertible value of individualism, the evil of collectivism, and the ravages of altruism on the human soul. And Atlas Shrugged, even more so, which is a novel that is, I think, a canonization of capitalism, is a political, moral, epistemological, ethical novel, even as a theory of sex. It's the most didactic novel in the history of novels because it is arguably probably the first novel it is the first time in which a novel was so explicitly used to convey as a vehicle a new philosophic system. And it offers human beings, probably first and foremost, a method of cognition. So the teachable moments, and there are many, the novel is sort of stamped with the imprimatur or the insignia in the form of a statement, I am going to teach you something, whether it's I'm going to teach you the meaning of money, the meaning of sex, the meaning of art, the nature of government, the application of law in a free society, the proper application of law, even how bad epistemology and faulty metaphysics lead not just to train wrecks, but to sexual impotence. So I think if we just put in parentheses for a moment Rand's insistence that art is not didactic, hers was. As I said last week, few people get aesthetic pleasure from, in the ordinary meaning sense of aesthetic pleasure, from listening to endless, although brilliant discourses on human psychology, economics, epistemology, metaphysics, etc., any more than one would from watching a brilliant professor with wisdom and techne and knowledge, a polymathic one with a polymathic mind, give a lecture on any subject matter as displayed in Atlas Shrugged. So I don't think that one contemplates such a figure as an end in himself any more one would Dagny, Rourke, Hugh Axton, Galt, or Reardon, or Toohey in reverse. Right? We sort of learn something from them. I don't know that one gets aesthetic pleasure from contemplating the conversation between let's say Rourke and what am I drawing a blank here?
Wynand.
Thank you, Wynand, those lovely conversations on the yacht. So a book that is a canonization of capitalism, where the philosophy, qua philosophy, in some sense supersedes the actual storyline, may contain elements of romanticism, as I said last week, but it is not emblematic or a definitional example of romanticism. And I went through those five features of romanticism. So Rand seems to break entirely with the 18th century notion, and her definition, which she admits is new, has little historical or literary continuity between the definition she offers and those advanced by the 18th, 19th, and 20th century theorists of romanticism. So she seems to be creating a sort of a neologistic, although a proper one, because she does give a really, really thorough definition of what she means and I'll get to this later, by what she means by an ideal man could never have been produced under Romanticism because of altruism. In her new formulation of Romanticism, she says the definition of Romanticism given here is mine. It is not a generally known or accepted one. And she says there's generally no accepted definition of Romanticism, nor any key element in art, nor of art itself. I think this is just, this is both empirically false and philosophically untenable. And unfortunately, one of the tendencies of, I say this quite respectfully, of course, as somebody who is a great admirer and appreciator of her work, but one of the tendencies of Rand to make very sweeping generalizations, as she often did in philosophy, which overlooks the traditions and genres within 18th and 19th century notions and conceptions of Romanticism that we looked at last week. So I think one is free to sort of formulate a very new theory of art, which I think she did in What is Romanticism? But what one cannot, with total disregard for its analytic and conceptual antecedents, simply substitute them with a new definition of one's own and call it Romanticism. So I think a scholarly and respectful definition would reconstruct the vague manner in which one might think Romanticism was built and defined and sort of build on it. But here Rand, I think, implies that before her definition in the manifesto, Romanticism was a non-concept or an anti-concept or a nonsensical concept or an incomplete concept would be the more charitable interpretation. And I think such disregard for the historical minutiae, which when codified gave 18th and 19th century Romanticism some definitional status, is a little bit hubristic, a little bit, just a little bit. So the definition of Romanticism most emphatically did not start with her delineation in the 1960s when she first published it in her volume 4 of the January to December 1965 edition of the Objectivist newsletter. And I think Rand tries to evade the didacticism that must inhere in her version of Romanticism by insisting that the most distinctive characteristic of Romanticism is a product of subconscious premises, right? This is the case of almost all fiction writing, including the novels of even someone like Stephen King, which she talks about the horror genre in the Romantic Manifesto. But what kind of subconscious premises, right? They have to be the kind that she says on 102, that they project a benevolent, childlike sense of life, one that glorifies man. There's nothing in the history of Romanticism that says the romantic protagonists must present a childlike, benevolent sense of life that glorifies man. That's Rand's amazing sense of life being translated here into a definition of Romanticism, which is actually quite alien to 18th century Romanticism, I think. All right, so... So subconscious premises, I think, are necessary conditions, but they're not sufficient conditions for Romanticism. And once we enter the realm of a presentation of virtues, embodied virtues, we enter a world of cognition, of a particular application of reason to the problems of reality, of abstracting from the myriad traits man possesses, and the one a romantic writer considers metaphysically important, right? So for her, Romanticism's essential characteristics is the projection of values, of moral values. The flaw that runs through the history of Romanticism literature, she thinks, is its failure to present a convincing hero and a convincing image of a virtuous man. She thinks is not possible because altruism has made this possible. Now, this might be true, and I think this is the case that a convincing image of a virtuous man has not been made possible, and I probably would dare to say before Rand's work, because she explicitly showed how altruism interfered with man's self-esteem and his ability to perform efficaciously throughout life. But I don't think this is a problem of Romanticism simpliciter. Okay. wrapping up, I want to say that prior to the 19th century, she says literature presented man as a helpless being whose life and action were determined by forces beyond his control, either by fate and the gods. And I think that this is just another kind of sweeping generalization that has to be respectfully contested, that when we look at someone like, I just finished reading Antigone last week, just for sure, the sheer pleasure of it, because it's one of my favorite plays, that Antigone, of course, for me personally, emerges as one of the great heroines in world literature, on par with, I would even say, Kira, whose fate was no more bound by the gods or any forces beyond her control, any more than Kira, speaking of Antigone, any more than Kira's fate was bound by the collectivist state. She had an indomitable spirit, that is Antigone. She was a volitional creature who acted according to her convictions. And the theme of the play is all about pride and moral integrity. And I think by Rand's own standards, we could see Antigone as a sort of forerunner to Romanticism. So I believe that the discussion and the dismissal of Romanticism prior to its alluded best expression, that is Atlas Shrugged, comes across sometimes as a straw man to reduce 19th century Romanticism to an ill-formed concept in order to establish Rand's work as a sort of new and proper iteration of the concept. So I believe in the spirit of scholarly and open objectivism, much needs to be rethought about Rand's a historical reworking of Romanticism, a reworked endeavor that places Rand's oeuvre as the singular exemplar of the genre itself. So I'll just say that Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead both have characteristics of Romanticism, the primacy of the individual, the primacy of imagination, but properly speaking, the way that Rand has defined Romanticism conceptually, which seems to have very little connection with its historical antecedents in the 18th century, one would be hard-pressed to place, identify the novels as constitutive examples of Romanticism. And I'll just end there.
Okay, well, great. We want to encourage everyone to share the room and raise your hand if you want to be part of this. Our TAS founder, David Kelly, is here. I will defer to you for the first question.
Thanks. Thanks, Scott. I'm sort of the honorary first questioner on these Clubhouse calls. And sometimes, you know, the topic is up my... right up my alley. This case, no, I'm not a specialist in aesthetics, so I've just been mainly listening. But I do, just two quick points. One is, we recently published a book by Walter Donway, a collection of his essays called Romanticism Reborn. And he has some essays in there that, you know, might be, you know, are cover some of the same ground as what Jason's saying and raise some of the same questions. So I'll just mention that as something that people interested in the topic may want to read. The other thing, more substantive, is Jason, Rand did comment extensively, or significantly anyway, on two 19th century novelists in particular, Dostoevsky and Hugo. Hugo was her hero in a way. Among others, you mentioned the Polish writer, I can't pronounce his name, but you know, the who wrote well, never mind.
Hold on.
Yes, thank you. But I wanted to ask you, that was an attempt on her part to connect her theory of art with actual examples of what she considered to be a romantic novel. So my question would simply be, do you Do you think of Hugo and Dostoevsky to just take those two as romantic novelists? And if so, you know, they're both 19th century. And any comments would be welcome on that. Thanks.
Right. So I think what Rand did was some of the kind of quarterback. I think what she did was sort of look retrospectively at the works of Dostoevsky and Hugo, and she saw elements in their works that she appreciated, affinities that she shared, and that were also, in some sense, not, from a literary standpoint, anathema or counter to what the 18th century Romantics had described Romanticism, that is, the sort of the primacy of the individual and the primacy of imagination. And she talks about Hugo's and Dostoevsky's inexhaustible imagination. So, but I think it's sort of like an issue of cherry picking here, because it's taking two particular romantics, one of whom she liked because of his sense of life, which was Hugo. She did not like Dostoevsky's sense of life, but she liked his enormous capacity to present evil in such a way that his psychological presentation of evil, and yet and concomitantly his condemnation of evil, was unprecedented, unparalleled in the history of novel writing, she thought. He was never able to project a moral hero or a good man in the way that Hugo attempted to, but his condemnation of evil was so admirable that she placed him within the romantic genre. I am still a little bit wary of identifying the projection of heroic values or man as a hero as a constitutive feature of Romanticism. I think it's there in the 18th century conceptions when we look at, for like, the Byronic hero, for example. But he's a quite tragic figure for obvious reasons. So the heroic figure never totally triumphs over the malevolent forces against him. So I think, to answer your question, I wouldn't put them outside the realm of Romanticism, but I just think it's very interesting that Rand sort of selectively cherry-picked two figures who both stylistically and in terms, one in terms of sense of life, one in terms of, I mean, she mirrored Dostoevsky in her condemnation of evil in terms of the villains of Atlas Shrugged and in the Fountainhead, of course, Ellsworth Tui, to be reflective or indicative of what Romanticism stood for. But Rand was not being a scholar. She was not being an academic in the Romantic Manifesto. I think she was trying to sort of present a new theory of art. And so her job was not to present a scholarly investigation of 18th and 19th century Romanticism and then built on it. This is one of the quarrels I've heard academics, aestheticians have with Rand, who've read that work, and I've spoken to them about it, and they've said, well, you know, she ought to have really investigated the history of Romanticism. What about people like Novalis? You know, what about, you know, the romantic poets? They're emblematic of the genre. But that's not what she was doing. So, I think she cherry-picked two figures who, and then some contemporary figures like Mickey Spillane, that I'm still trying to figure out what makes a crime writer a romantic figure, because there's nothing, again, going back into the historical genre that says that, you know, a heroic crime fighter navigating between the pristine registers of good and evil is a symbol of Romanticism. There's nothing in my understanding of 18th century Romanticism that says that. We more find this in beast epics or medieval drama, medieval plays, which are just Manichaean conceptions of binary conceptions of life, good and evil, and one fighting on behalf of the other. But I don't see that as a constitutive. I really don't see that as a constitutive feature of Romanticism. I don't see anything in the literature that suggests that the way that she presents Mickey Spillane, that he's an emblematic figure of how the 18th and 19th century Romantics configured Romanticism.
I'm not sure of the timeline of when she started using romantic realism. Maybe that's part of why she qualified it later.
Well, it was in the 60s.
Right, but I mean, in relation to when the Romantic Manifesto came out.
The Romantic Manifesto came out in the 70s, but she started writing about it in her newsletter, in the Objectivist newsletter, in the mid-1960s. I mean, I have both volumes of... I have the volume of the newsletter and I have the volume of the Objectivist. And I was looking at when she first penned anything on aesthetics. And it was in, I think, volume 4 of the January 1965 volume. And then, of course, she turned, as usual, she turned a lot of the articles that she wrote in the newsletter and the Objectivist into that subsequently became, you know, even Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology and What is Capitalism? And the Romantic Manifesto. But it was the mid-60s that she started writing about this notion of romantic realism.
Well, that I'm trying to differentiate romanticism from romantic realism and giving her maybe more license for why she was describing it in a way that isn't the historical definition.
Right. I think that the only thing that could be affixed with realism would be to appeal to her metaphysics, right? Something on the order of it's not some sort of it's certainly not naturalism, but it's not some sort of idealistic, transcendental tale that prioritizes the primacy of consciousness over reality, that whatever her fiction is about, it has to be based and be grounded in reality as the writer perceives these metaphysical precepts in man, in nature, that he or she selectively recreates into a stylized work of art. So that's the only thing that I can think that could be derived from realism, is that it has to be predicated on existence units of perception that are to be gained not from some sort of Kantian, you know, or Cartesian creation of reality that consciousness manufactures, but that we discover in reality through the perception, through the use of our senses, and that any idea of romanticism as being predicated on the primacy of consciousness over existence was to be completely refuted. So maybe she was just simply protecting herself from any mistaken notion that one might associate romanticism with the primacy of consciousness over existence. That is, you know, the creation that the mind creates reality as opposed to the mind discovering something objective in reality. I don't know, David, what do you think? That's my sense.
That he may have stepped away for a moment or not be right there. Okay. But in the meantime, we'll go to John. Thank you for joining us today. John, are you able to unmute?
I'm going to have to check out and come back.
You're here. We can hear you.
Oh, fine. All right. Thank you. Thank you again, Jason. Really excellent. I was wondering two things. One, what do we know about her assignments as a scriptwriter, script rewriter, her work in Hollywood, and who she associated with in terms of the aesthetics and where her ideas might have come from there? And then secondly, I missed how you would characterize her aesthetics. What do you call her two great novels? What category do you put them in?
Well, thank you, John. You know, that's what I was struggling with last week when I said that I could not have given a thoroughly scholarly reconstruction of Romanticism last week. But when we looked at some of the fundamental characteristics of Romanticism, and there were five of them that we looked at, you know, especially this valorization and this of childhood and of the primacy of intuition and feelings over reason, which clearly are not values prized by Rand at all or glorified in her work. I was trying to find a moniker that would best describe her work, and I think I'm satisfied with the idea that she wrote highly didactic philosophical thrillers or highly didactic philosophical novels. The didacticism is there. Didacticism is not a feature of Romanticism, notwithstanding Victor Hugo's, I just skip over those long essays on history. But those aren't didactic. Those are more informative. I don't find there's anything didactic in Victor Hugo's work. But didacticism is not a feature of Romanticism. So I feel comfortable describing Rand as a philosophical fiction writer, right? Because that's really, really what she is. She's in both of her major novels. She's presenting a philosophic system in fictionalized form. So I think of her as unprecedented in that way. There have been writers who have attempted. Jean-Paul Sartre comes to mind. And I do appreciate Sartre as a philosopher, and I like his plays, but not his novels. I think he's failed miserably to try to fictionalize his philosophy in ways that Rand has succeeded. So I mean, there have been writers who have tried to do it. So I feel more comfortable casting her less as a romantic novelist and more as a philosophical philosophical novelist. That's how I teach two types of different courses in literature. One is the Victorian novel, and one is the philosophical novel. And I always include her Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead in the philosophical novel course that I teach, because that's what it is. She's a philosophical novelist. I mean, that's the best term I can think of using. She's a philosophical. That's not even doing justice to her work, but that's what she is. She's a philosophical novel. I think she's a philosophical novelist.
Good.
Jason, can I jump? This is David. Can I just jump in for a second? In that course on the philosophical novel, what other works do you read that you would consider to be philosophical novels?
Well, I do parts of, I cannot do all of Victor Hugo. Because there are philosophical themes that are there. But I do a lot of the existentialist works. I do a lot of Camus, The Plague, The Stranger. Although I don't particularly like the novel, I think if you're going to teach a course on the philosophical novel, you have to teach Nausea, which makes me nauseous. Actually, it makes me nauseous. But so I teach Nausea. I teach all of Camus' plays, the five, The Misunderstanding, Caligula, all the plays that he wrote, I teach. I just include the plays as part of the novels. Strangely, I think I teach some of, I include Hard Times because I do think it's a philosophical novel, albeit in a very, very disguised way. And I also teach The Heart of Darkness in that course. Because I think it's a quasi philosophical discourse on several, let me just say several things. I won't get in because that's going to lead to a whole different conversation. But I do think I find it to be a very philosophical novel on the nature of identity, on the nature of the self, on many, many things. I find it quite philosophical.
One I would want to see in that course would be Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, I've never taught that novel. No.
Jason, wondering if you've spent any time on Ayn Rand's early fiction. I find it some of the most interesting and enjoyable to read, not necessarily from it's not didactic, except perhaps Red Pawn to an extent. But it's just these fun stories, short stories, some fun, actually, The Husband I Bought, quite tragic, but it's just a little bit more of a window into her as a developing novelist and a developing literary artist, as opposed to a developing philosopher.
Well, that's interesting because I actually do teach I teach Red Pawn as a short story. But I like the early Ayn Rand and I read it just for my own pleasure. I mean, I think Madonna had actually, can you believe this, of all persons, Madonna had optioned, has bought good copy. Yeah, I think Madonna optioned good copy years ago. Which other one do I like? I like The Escort. I think that's a very kind of naughty story. And I like the plays. I actually had held a reading group years ago on Think Twice and Ideal. So I like her short stories a lot because they're just, I mean, I guess I haven't read that much O. Henry, to be honest with you. But I guess they're like in the spirit of how she describes O. Henry, who was one of her literary heroes. I do like the short stories. I don't use them in class because they're not philosophical and they're more, sense of life stories. But I do include Red Pawn because it's very accessible and it's very short and the students love it more than they actually like aspects of they don't like me assigning John Galt's speech at all but they actually like the speech they actually like the speech at the end they appreciate it. They just don't like to be forced to read 60 pages of someone talking.
Well, if they like Red Pawn, then they'll love Red Pawn, the graphic novel and the animated series.
Yeah, they should. Yeah.
Very nice. I just wanted to go back to something from last week's discussion. You and David were talking about In Atlas Shrugged. It was almost what could be seen as a bit malicious by Rand with the people that were responsible and their moral degree of responsibility in each car of the train. And I wanted to just offer another interpretation that she's trying to show people that becoming tools of a corrupt establishment, can't protect you from the facts of reality, like putting a coal train through tunnels.
But there's a glee. There's a sense of glee with which they're offed. They're shanked, to use a colloquial term, which I rarely use. But they're just killed off with this kind of. There's a sense that there's moral culpability between them and the individuals who are responsible for the actual damage that's being done. And again, I always go back, Scott, to this very, very, very important, and it's double-lined in my journal, where Rand says, one should rarely, if ever, judge people by what they say, or even by what they say. One judges a person by what he or she does, because people often say things and later change their minds on what they say. I thought that was very, very benevolent, and I thought it was very, very insightful of her. And one could say the same thing about beliefs, in the sense that you don't kill people off because of the beliefs. All of these people held beliefs. There was nothing to suggest that they had ever translated their beliefs into any kind of ominous action. The sociology professor, the mother of two children, the woman in room at car 8 who believed that as a consumer she had a right to transportation, whether the railroad wished to provide it or not, she's killed off. The businessman who acquired this business on from a government loan under the Equalization of Opportunity Bill. Again, there's the degree of culpability. There's nothing to suggest that the belief tied them with some kind of action that translated into the infliction of harm done onto people. So,
I'm saying that it's not even that she's necessarily saying they deserved it, but are symbolic of the types of people that allow this type of, dystopian world to come about.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That's fair. I mean, this is one of the benefits of the open approach, but we can speak our minds, and I'm just curious how much of this involves kind of a reassessment of Rand, kind of taking into account what some of these academics have been saying about how she misused romanticism.
Well, I don't really take academics seriously on Rand for the simple reason that very few of them read her seriously and read her charitably. This comes from my having taught in the comparative literature department for 9 years, along with teaching the philosophy department, and having taught a lot of romantic thinkers, and also reading a lot of theory on romanticism, and also having my first introduction to Ayn Rand was not The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged. It was, but the first book of hers that I actually did read, because I did not like The Fountainhead at first. I grew to like it the second time I started it, was The Romantic Manifesto. So I have a great appreciation for what Rand has accomplished in The Romantic Manifesto. What she says about that essay on art and cognition is truly, truly a brilliant essay. It's probably the most brilliant essay in the book. Art and Sense of Life. It's just beautiful. It's just clear. There's a lucidity of thought that's there that is unprecedented in other theories of art that I've seen. But then the scholar in me, wants to say that, look, you can't just with these in a sort of sweepingly generalized way dismiss, like Rand makes these statements like, there has been no theory of romanticism before she decided to give her definition, which is just empirically not the case. And that there are no theories of art. I mean, what about people who wrote, Mary McCarthy wrote amazing, although they were Marxists, Diane and Lionel Trilling wrote tomes about theories of art. And one doesn't have to agree with them, but they have theories of art. There were Dorothy Parker wrote on art. There are lots of people while Rand was still learning to speak English who wrote tons of stuff on art and romanticism. And so the scholar in me, just unpersuaded by academics, wanted to sort of rethink how to have these books be ensconced, whether they're romantic works of literature or whether we should call them something else, because to call them romanticism, they really have to have some sort of historical continuity with the tradition. You don't call yourself an Aristotelian if you believe in the theory of the forms, you know, or if you don't call yourself a rationalist if you adhere to the theory of Burke. So that's where I'm actually coming from.
That's fair. That's part of objectivity, is even being willing, you know, to call out Rand where she's not right. It helps us defend the essentials more, I think. John, go ahead if you want to get in here.
There's a hole here. There's a lacunae academically, I suspect, on did she actually do during those men, that industry was spectacularly successful financially and in terms of reaching hundreds of millions of people. There's something to that art that she must have learned, where she was part of the machine. She was in the middle of it and was invited there by the tops of those companies. I mean, there was, that's an area where the scholarship needs to be. Perhaps it's impossible. None of it was written down, and nobody knows what she worked on, what her product was, and it's all lost to that. But that's something, I don't think we can leave that out. She had a sense of art that was certainly influenced by the commercial success of Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was influenced by it before she even came to the United States, because as we learn in her biographies, when she was behind the Iron Curtain, she would watch propaganda films made by the Soviet regime, in which they would take snippets of various American films and, of course, turn the heroes into villains and vice versa. But she could even just see in watching the film, watching the actual, footage, that there was a world out there where people wore beautiful things, where people drove beautiful cars, where cities were well illuminated and bustling. So there was that influence. And then, of course, when she came to the United States and moved in for several months with relatives in Chicago, they owned a few movie theaters, and she would go with her notebook and watch all of the movies and grade them all in terms of what she thought of their plot and their characterization, and give them all scores. And then, of course, there was also the influence of the early black and whites in the love triangles that you find in some of those early films, and seeing that continued through many of Ayn Rand's storylines.
I think, John, if you want to get a good, it's been years since I've read this book, but it's called Ayn Rand, the Russian Radical by Chris Matthew Skibara. And he, among other things, he talks about the influence that, the influences that Rand must have impressed themselves on Rand during the 1920s. He talks about Forerunners to Atlas Shrugged. There was a particular novel and a particular movie, silent movie, in which men of the mind actually did go on strike in some sense, not to the scale that Rand developed it, but that as a moviegoer and to the extent that she actually might have read any of the pulp fiction of the era, these might have affected her sensibilities. It's been a long time since I read the book, and actually when I was in graduate school almost 30 years ago. But that's an interesting book that talks about not just the aesthetic influences on Rand, but also the intellectual influences going back to Russia.
And going to the emblematic romanticism and the didactic romanticism, if you will, what a contrast between, as Jennifer referenced, watching the overdubs of American movies in the Soviet Union versus the real product in Hollywood. I mean, it's learning the difference between that hard, I imagine, Soviet didacticism versus, if you will, a true romanticism in the Hollywood product. And then, obviously, in Hollywood, there's always been didacticism, emblemism, certainly, in many movies. And that's what she was aspiring to, was to make great movies from her novels. And I'll leave it there.
John, if I could just jump in for a second and forgive me, Jason.
Yeah.
Anne Heller's book, Ayn Rand and the World She Made, is a detailed biography. And it's been a while, but I'm sure it goes into all the Hollywood background. But one thing, so I recommend that book, Anne Heller, Ayn Rand and the World She Made, if you haven't seen it. But the other thing is that many people have observed that even in Atlas Shrugged, which has obviously more philosophical presentations than other novels, her other novels, it's easy to see that she was a screenwriter. There are many scenes in the movie where it was written as if this is intended to be filmed. The one example I remember is when we first meet Dagny Taggart on the train in chapter one, part one, chapter one. The description starts with her leg and moves up to her full figure as she's sitting in a Taggart transcontinental train. We had a talk once, I think it was by maybe Gladstein on that score. And in that respect, related to it, I just want to push back a little bit on Jason about Atlas Shrugged as a didactic novel. I agree with what you're saying about, you know, it has philosophical speeches that are intended to inform the audience and inform the reader, not just to tap his sense of life. But Atlas Shrugged is an amazingly well-constructed novel, as far as I can see, that, you know, it is suspenseful. It is a page turner. The plot, and I've spent a lot of time on this when I was helping with the movie adaptations. There's so many things that are just clever, unexpected twists and turns. So her imagination was well at work on top of her philosophical points. I don't deny what you're saying about the philosophical content and the explicit didactic lessons. But I do think it has, it's not, I've read other libertarian-oriented novels that are just frameworks for making a philosophical point. Atlas is a really interesting story. So I'll leave it there.
Great. I don't know if you want to comment quickly, Jason. We're at the bottom of the hour. So we have a ton of stuff going on at the Atlas Society next week. Monday, Stephen Hicks will be joining our July book club on explaining postmodernism. We'll be back on Clubhouse Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Richard Salzman will be back on Friday. Even Wednesday, we have Scholars Asking Scholars with Jason Hill being interviewed by Richard Salzman. That should be a good one. Big week upcoming. You can find out all about it at atlassociety.org/events. Thank you to Professor Hill and everyone who participated today. Hope you'll join us next week for some great content as well. Take care.